Okay, so for those of you out in Zoom land, you see that Nancy and Bill and Alicia are here. And then over here, your old pals, Amaria and Sylvia. Okay. We'll move things around later.
Must be warm in Hawaii there.
Is it warm where you are? Mm-hmm. Probably not as warm as where I was. Troncones is in the high 90s. I was dying. Oh, so it's, actually, I'm going to be talking a little bit about Troncones tonight.
Do you want a cushion to put the...
No. I mostly know what I'm going to say off the top of my head anyway. So can everyone out there hear me? Thumbs up? Great. Okay. So when I was still teaching here, and Nancy will remember this, we were always urged to be prepared to give the elevator talk. The elevator talk was, if you happen to be in an elevator with someone and you only had one or two floors, to explain to them what made your school so unique. I mean, literally you had 2 minutes, three at the max. Because lots of schools say that they are teaching the whole child. Peninsula says, well, that may be so, but. So exactly what is it that makes our school unique? I had to think about this a lot. I'm still not sure that I have a very good elevator talk. But while I was on my vacation, there are only 10 units at this place. It was absolutely beautiful. There were hundreds and hundreds of iguanas, which lived right outside of our patio. A black furry tarantula that lived on our patio, and a Mexican tree frog that found its way between the glass door and the screen. And we had to have the maid come in with her broom gently. So there was lots of wildlife. But at one point, when my husband was out at the pool, because, by the way, the ocean there is also in the 80s. So between 10 and 4, the beach was absolutely empty because it was just too hot. And you couldn't even go in the ocean to get cooled off. Very different than Hawaii. So we either hung out at the pool, or we hung out on our patio, or we hung out on the other patio that overlooked the ocean in the shade. I still got burned in the first 2 days. Because I didn't realize that even in the shade, you got to watch out. But I think it was like the second or third day, my husband comes back to me and he says, oh, I just met this really nice guy in the pool and we got to chatting and we were just talking about what it was we did. And I explained that that you were a Zen teacher. And so the man rightly said, well, so what are the tenets of Zen? And Keith very wisely said, oh, my wife will have to talk to you about that. Meanwhile, I am rolling my eyes because, of course, the last thing I feel like doing on my vacation is talking about Zen with someone who knows nothing about it. But I thought about it for a while, and I realized, I mean, at first it was like, oh boy, do I really have to go out there and talk to this person? Maybe I can just avoid him. But then I realized, well, here we are. Here's the emergency, right? Here's somebody asking about it. The least I can do is try to answer. And I realized that For someone who knows absolutely nothing, maybe they've heard the word Zen because it's the name of a perfume. I don't know. I realized I needed to give the elevator talk. So just for a moment, I'm going to be silent because I want you to think about what you think you would say given only 1 or 2 minutes. What would be the tenets of Zen or Buddhism that you would think most important in a way that this person could understand? Okay, so I'm just going to shut up here for a minute and let you think. Okay, so I would like each of you to tell me one thing that you think would be really important in a way that someone could understand who knows nothing about Buddhism. Who would like to go first?
Lil,
please go ahead.
This is great. I've been having to work on pitches for my novel and a potential new book that I haven't written yet. So this is great. So my sentence would be that the practice of following my breath and letting my mind become still has led me to live with more clarity.
Great. That's something anybody could understand. They'd probably have a lot of follow-up questions, but thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Sylvia, did you have your hand up?
No.
Oh. Sorry. Oh, see? Nancy, go ahead.
What I feel like this happened to me just before Thanksgiving. One of the kids in the third grade class saw my red string and said, "Oh, I know what that is. That's a protection string. Martha last year in our Spanish class told us about it, how it's supposed to protect you." And I said, "Oh, well, it is called that, a blessing string or a protection string. But for me, I think of it as a reminder when I see it to pay attention to what I'm doing and what I'm saying and to be kind."
Perfect. And something a child could understand. Anybody out there in the Zoom audience? Yeah, go ahead, Diane.
Well, a lot of things came to mind, but I would say that it's a practice that started with the enlightenment of Buddha, and Buddha had many teachings. The main ones was to sit still and to observe yourself so that you could pay attention and be in the moment.
Great, thank you. Okay. Wing, you want to chime in while you're there?
No, my mind is blank.
A great Zen answer.
I would say for me, in the practice of sitting and being quiet, it has opened my heart and my mind to be a more observant and hopefully kind person.
A lot of follow-up questions there too. Mm-hmm. How does that work? Okay. Anybody else? Yeah, Sylvia, go ahead.
All right. First of all, our practice is Soto Zen, which is one of the schools of Zen. It enables me to be present, to be truly alive, moment after moment, to live my life fully.
You get much better than that. Mario or Alicia? No? There is no wrong answer here.
I would say it's a, not a religion, but it is a religious practice. That is at once personal, but overflows into how one dances with the world, people, nature. And it's a kind of a middle way. It doesn't go to extremes. Something like that.
All right. Well, many of the things you said were things I thought about. I want to back up a little bit. Several weeks ago, I lectured on the Gandharan Buddha, which is the type of Buddha that's at Tassajara. And if you recall, what I told everyone, if in case you didn't know, is that the Greeks invaded the area of Gandhara in India about 300 years after Shakyamuni died. And they were so taken with his teachings that they decided to start following. Many of them followed his teachings. And they brought them back to Greece. Now, you may realize Shakyamuni himself, Siddhartha, did not want statues of himself. That was never his idea. In fact, he would probably be horrified, especially all the golden Buddhas, or even, you know, the 1,200 feet high Buddhas. You know, that would probably be completely antithetical. But the Greeks, of course, were used to immortalizing all of their Hellenistic idols, and so they promptly started doing the same thing with the Buddha. But of course, they made the Buddha look more like them, which is the case of the Buddha in every country. In Nepal, there's a Nepalese Buddha. In Burma, there's a Burmese Buddha. And you can tell the differences by the length of the ear, the length of the face, the shape of the eye. But the one that's at Tassajara is definitely Gandharan, because it looks like a Greek face with the typical Kesa, you know, covering the left shoulder. So Buddha originally was only represented by a couple of very small things. One was a wheel, the wheel of the Dharma. And the second was a sandal, right? Or a footprint. So as usual, humans just cannot help themselves. And so off we went, making all these statues. But I realized that if I had to go out to that pool and talk to this young man, he was maybe in his 30s, who didn't know anything about Zen, I was going to go back to the Greeks. Because anybody who has a Western education knows at least a little bit. They may not know who said it, but they've heard it. So I figured that the best thing I could do was say something that sounded familiar and then point out that it was actually borrowed. And it was borrowed by bringing it from Gandhara back to Greece. So the very first one, and we learn this really early, is Socrates. Socrates saying, know thyself. He very famously once declared, that the unexamined life was not worth living. I think a Zen teacher would probably say the same thing. And when he was asked to sum up what all philosophical commandments could be reduced to, he replied, "Know yourself." Now, this is really a wonderful statement. Because, first of all, how do you do that? How do you come to know yourself? And in Zen practice, that is exactly what we are doing. We are doing self-reflection through the medium of meditation. That's the first part. The second part of knowing yourself is establishing a relationship with a teacher and a sangha. Because you might think that you're being very honest with yourself, but maybe you're kind of wiggling around, and it's really helpful to have someone else hold up a mirror and say, are you sure? Is that really so? And then thirdly, you know, so the teacher part is really important, whether you call it a sage or a master or a teacher or a guru or a lama or a Rinpoche or a sensei or Roshi. The teacher-student relationship requires incredible honesty and incredible kindness. Because sometimes things get pointed out that are hard to take in. And you don't want it slammed in your face, but you do appreciate knowing where you could maybe improve a little bit. But then the third thing within this knowing thyself is what we're doing here tonight, sangha. Because each one of us then acts as a teacher for each other. Each one of us is noticing, how is that person sitting? How does that person ask a question? How does that person help set up? How does that person help take down? And we help each other this way. We notice these things. So Socrates also said, and it is related, that the only true wisdom is in knowing that you know nothing. Does this sound familiar? Not knowing is most intimate? Well, where did they get that from? One wonders. So that was the first thing I thought I would bring up. I would bring up Socrates and knowing thyself. And I figured we'd probably have a long conversation in the pool about this. And that about the time I started shriveling up, I would say, well, you know, I have to leave now, but I'll come back if you want me to. Because there's another part that's really important. And that is Hippocrates and the Hippocratic Oath. Do no harm. How do you do that? Now, you might think that that's easy. Oh, well, you just don't do any harm. Well, first of all, you've got to know yourself, right? You've got to go back to number one, because a lot of people actually don't realize that they're causing harm. I once asked somebody who used to get angry on, you know, a fairly regular basis and blow it all out, and I asked this person, I said, so when you're done being angry, then it's over for you, right? I mean, it's just like gone. The person said, yes. I said, but it's not gone for the person that you got angry at. They're carrying the burden of your behavior. That was like a, oh. So in order to do no harm, we have to go back to step one of know thyself. But the other part of doing no harm is you really, really need to understand emptiness. You need to understand that there is no permanent abiding nature of anything, and that it is all connected. So when the black furry tarantula showed up on our patio, about 20 years ago, my husband's idea would have been to step on it to get rid of it. But with enough osmosis through me, he now helps the spiders out. And we figured out a way to get it in a cup and move it out into the yard where it could probably find better food. This is because that spider has some part to play in our life. And it wasn't causing any trouble, and it wasn't going to do anything to us, because actually tarantulas are pretty non-aggressive creatures. And every time I help a spider get out of the zendo, right, instead of just going over and there's a part of me that feels virtuous, right? Because I am causing no harm. But, of course, there is no such thing also as causing no harm. And when you know yourself and you know the world, you understand that you're causing harm even when you don't intend to cause harm. Everybody had to come here in a car tonight. Hundreds of bugs gave their life for you to be able to come here to cause no harm. So part of doing no harm is knowing yourself and allowing yourself, which is what you were saying, Sylvia, to be continually aware of yourself in every moment, physically, mentally, emotionally. It's pretty hard to do. It's pretty hard to be here in every moment. You get distracted when you're teaching. You get distracted pretty easily, right? It's hard to, oh, right, what about that kid over there that I've completely forgot about, right? So fundamentally, we actually can't do no harm, but we do come to the understanding of doing the least amount of harm possible. Just about this time, I would be completely shriveled up in the pool had I not taken a break. But there's still two other points to make. And I realized I did not have an easy answer from a Greek point of view until I went and looked it up, and it turns out that Plato had something to say in all of this too. Because first you get to know yourself intimately. And then you begin, because of that, to understand how to do no harm. But in order to do either of these, you have to be disciplined. And you have to have perseverance. You cannot write a novel unless you sit down every morning and write. And you cannot learn how to play a piano piece unless you sit down and practice it over and over and over. So Plato said, the first and greatest victory is to conquer yourself. To be conquered by yourself is of all things most shameful and vile. To go towards what is not easy. This is not our culture. Our culture says everything should be easy, and if it's not, find something else to do that is. We want it to be happy and rewarding, and we want to get it the way we want it. But the only way to really deeply understand suffering is by going towards it, is by sitting with the person who's dying, by dealing with the pain that you've been given without getting taken out of your center. By not having everything the way we want it to be, we understand and can empathize with all those people who do not have our life. You know, there I am in Troncones with a beautiful beach and a pool and hundreds of iguanas. And I'm reading my news feed in the morning about the hostages and the hope to have a ceasefire and the children who have been taken hostage. And it doesn't make any sense. It's such a disconnect between this beautiful place that I'm enjoying and knowing halfway around the world the incredible suffering that is happening. And so that leads me to the fourth thing that I would talk about to this young man if he hadn't already decided to leave by that point, which he might. And that was specific to our practice, Mahayana Zen Buddhism and Vajrayana Buddhism, which is service to others, the Bodhisattva path. So Plato again has something to say about this. He says, the highest form of knowledge is empathy, for it requires us to suspend our egos and live in another's world. And so while I was there in this beautiful place, surrounded by meticulous gardens and the sound of crashing water, I also took time to send prayers and bows to all of those who are living in another world right now, and hoping and praying that that world will change and become a happier place for them. So in the Bodhisattva path, empathy and compassion are the actions that arise from number one, knowing ourself, and number two, trying to cause the least amount of harm possible. These are all how we relate to people in the world in a daily way. The person who is at the cash register, the person at the bank, the person that we're talking to on the phone about our Wi-Fi and internet who are making us crazy. Every one of these people is important. And I sent something out at Thanksgiving, which is really important to remember. It was from Nelson Mandela. And he said, you know, no one is born hating. You learn how to hate. And he said, this is actually encouraging, because if you can learn how to hate, you can also learn how to love. And given what happened to Mr. Mandela and how many years he spent in prison, this is actually an incredible conclusion to come to. Gandhi the same way. And Mother Teresa, my goodness, living and working in the slums with the worst kinds of disease and poverty, and yet they all come to the same conclusion. They all became bodhisattvas. They were all interested in how to teach love. So why is this important? Why did I bother going through this thought process? Because it took me all morning to think about this, when I could have been out at the beach. But you never know when someone is going to ask you something about this crazy thing that you do. As a bodhisattva, your practice, your work, is to be able to answer them clearly and without jargon, in a way that they could understand, that a child could understand. So Suzuki Roshi was actually a master at this. I mean, I always love that story with David Chadwick, where Suzuki Roshi has gone on and on for 45 minutes, very heavily accented English, pretty esoteric stuff. And finally at the end, when it's question and answer time, David Chadwick says, Roshi, Do you think that you could tell us what practice is in just a couple of words? I'm sure it was, it could have been conceived as very insulting, but without missing a beat. Suzuki Roshi says to him, everything changes. Bam. That one, and I hope that I can, in the case of an emergency, I just might do the right thing. These are simple and yet absolutely accurate expressions of our practice. But I think more importantly for us as Western practitioners, it is really helpful for us to be able to think of practice without all the jargon, to put it in terms that are familiar, because it's too easy. You know, it's my big complaint about the word God. I don't mind that people believe in God. Maybe even I believe in God. The problem is the word itself, because everybody thinks that it's their God, or they have some idea about what God is, or who God is, or what gender God is. And, you know, I guess to me, whatever idea you could have about God is too small, right? How can you have any idea? If God is everything, what can you possibly say? Most of us do not speak an Asian language. Most of us do not speak Japanese or Chinese, with the exception of a few of us here. But the fact is, Zen is beyond language. We don't have to talk about it in language. But we do have to act. This is why we have right speech, right action, and right livelihood. But you know, there's a famous saying that the best way to teach is by example. You know, it's that old thing, the joke about, you know, do as I say, not as I do. Well, that never works. So you also don't say, do as I do. You just do it. You just act like a bodhisattva. You just be empathic and compassionate and kind. But I do think it's very easy to get caught up in intellectual ideas in Buddhism. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't know Dogen, and that we shouldn't read some of the more contemporary people, and we shouldn't know about the two truths of Nagarjuna. But it does mean that we really need to remember what's most fundamental. We really need to remember. We sit down in chairs and cushions to look clearly at this one here, so that when we go out in the world, we're still watching this one here. Oh, I see. I exaggerate a lot. Or, ooh, that was a lie. Or, that wasn't a very nice thing I just said. We're never going to not be doing those things. But becoming aware that we do them. As a storyteller, exaggeration is actually something that you do. But as a person talking to other people, I have to watch that very carefully. Oh, did I really do that 2 or 3 times? No, I did it once. That kind of thing. It seems like a small thing, and it usually is, but it becomes a habit. All of our little things become habits. And that's what we have to become aware of. So the ironic thing is that the man left before I had a chance to talk to him. No, it turned out he was leaving that afternoon. And I was so busy coming up with my, what was I going to say to him, and not wanting to go out right then because I felt really unprepared. But I just thought that was hilarious that after all of that, but I thought, well, it will make a great story when I come home. Anyway, thank you so much. Thank you all. I think, did you hear that last little part of how I didn't, Diane, that I didn't get to Oh, Diane's coming back in. Because she's going to laugh when she hears this. Diane's iPhone. Something happened. So, Diane, I just told them that the totally ironic thing is that by the time I'd finished thinking about all this, the man had checked out of the hotel.
I can't get the video. Let's see.
So I was never able to give him my elevator talk, but I gave it to you instead.
Well, very good. There was a statement by Suzuki Roshi when he was asked, what is Zen good for? And he said, good for nothing.
Another snappy response. But see, again, one that makes you, like I said, there's going to be follow-up questions.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean, right, by that? What do you mean everything changes? Well, look around you. Well, yes, but what does that have to do with anything? Or what you said, it's not really a religion, but it is a religious practice. What on earth do you mean by that? It's great because it gives you the opportunity to then clarify, but still without using any jargon in a way that they can understand. This is really important. It's important mostly for ourselves to be really clear. Why am I doing this? Sylvia just went, well. All right, my dears. Well, it's a little late. I went over. I don't suppose there's any questions other than the fact that I had a great vacation. Thank you very much. You do.
Nancy and I saw a short video of this monk, a Tibetan monk, who was talking about that teachers always teach. And so they showed all these guys, I mean, some people that they could barely walk, but they never stopped teaching. Someone would come to them and they would teach. And they said, a real teacher, here we are, always is there to teach. If somebody comes to them and they need something, they just teach whatever it is that they can do with it.
Well, see, and that was so interesting. When Keith came and told me about this, and the first response was, no. And then I was like, what is wrong with you? Well, but why not? You know, I mean, what would have been the big deal? So
you're kind of like the doctor on the plane. Is there any doctors here? Just be quiet.
Let me tell you about my history. All right. Well, let's do our after lecture. Oh, wait, I'm sorry, I just need to turn off the recording. Otherwise, Jill has to do this. There we go, yeah.